Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Hello, and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin is here, and it's time for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, which has become quite popular, actually. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of this brand new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Hello again, Jimmy.
Hello, Cy. Let's get weird.
All right. Let's get a little bit weird. But before we get weird, I have two items of business. First of all, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is today because it's Friday.
Yes.
What's dropping?
This morning at 4:30 a.m., which is when we release, so it's up for the people on the East Coast who wanted to listen to it driving to work, we did the apparition of La Salette.
Oh, you get a little Catholic something.
Yeah.
All right.
We have a nice mix.
You do.
I have at least one religious topic a month, at least one UFO thing a month, and others filled in with scientific and paranormal mysteries.
Ghosts or weird orbs or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Have you ever done Oak Island?
I have not yet done Oak Island, but that would be one for an upcoming UFO slot. I've got it on the list. I have like 8 years worth of topics on the list.
I'm sure you do. It's a weird world. It's a mysterious world.
Yeah.
I'm not giving out the number. I'm reading questions. And that's the other thing, item of business I have to do. I have the weird questions organized and in order for me on the Google Doc. So assistant producer Marie is on top of it.
She totally cut and pasted it.
Yeah. She did a fine job. I feel like that might have been slightly dismissive.
No. I emailed them to her, and she cut and pasted them.
All right. You ready for some weird questions?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let the weirdness begin. Tim asks this. I was reading the news recently and was a bit overwhelmed with all the bad news. Somewhat unconsciously, I said, Jesus, we need you. And that triggered my question. What does Jimmy think the world would be like now if Jesus' incarnation had still not happened? Oh, this is a good, weird question. All other things the same, where would we be without Christ's teaching and the church to have guided us the last few millennia? Two millennia, to be exact.
So, it's an interesting question. There's a whole genre of what's called alt history or alternative history, where authors will try to imagine how world history would have gone differently if something had not happened at a particular juncture. And so you have a lot of things like, what if the South won the Civil War? What if Hitler got the bomb? What if Abraham Lincoln were not assassinated? All those kind of things.
Right.
And it's impossible to know for sure, but we can speculate on such things. I would say that without and here I'm not saying that God would leave us unredeemed. He could redeem us in another way, or he could have Jesus come in the 22nd century instead of the first.
Yeah.
But
then that would be the first century.
Of the Christian age.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, in that case, we would now be in the 28th century of the year of the founded city, which is the timekeeping system the Romans used.
Right.
I would suppose that the Roman Empire probably would not exist today. Even with Christianity, it wasn't able to survive long term. I mean, it survived for a long time, but it wasn't permanent. And so I would suspect it would have fallen apart like it did in our history. And we'd have different nations, probably with some of them with different names, some of them with maybe the same names. But the key thing that I think would have happened, or a key thing that I think would have happened is, well, let's we would still have Judaism.
Right.
Because Judaism predates Christianity and is a divinely created religion, and God has promised it's not going to go out of existence till the end of the world.
Yeah.
You know, we're still going to have Jewish people here at the end. So we would still have Judaism. We would not have Christianity, obviously, and we would not have Islam, because Islam broke away from Christianity. We probably would have more paganism in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We might have some prominent monotheisms. Judaism may not have gotten huge, but in this alternate timeline we're imagining, but Zoroastrianism
might
have. Also, there could be other religions that would be more prominent than they are, like Mithraism may not have died out in this alternate timeline. That was a religion that in the first century was quite popular among Roman soldiers. And so without Christianity moving in and spreading, the soldiery of the empire could have continued to spread Mithraism.
Mm-hmm.
We would not have the restraining influence on world history of Christ's ethic of brotherly love.
Right.
And that has played an enormous role in civilizing people and in restraining our otherwise fallen urges. And without that as a without the ethic of universal love, at least held up as an ideal, however imperfectly people do with it,
right?
I suspect the world would be a more barbaric place, and it probably thus would not. It's hard to say what the impact of that would be on technology. It's entirely possible that technology would not have developed as far as it has without the stability that the ethic of brotherly love has provided, because that creates situations of greater peace, which allows a greater flourishing of the economy because it's not totally being destroyed by war all the time.
Right.
On the other hand, war can be a stimulus to technological development. And so it's also possible that we could have gotten the same technology or even better through it being spurred on by war. But I suspect the world would be a more violent place than it has been. And it's been violent enough, but I suspect it would have been even more violent.
Tim, thank you for starting us off with a great question for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Kevin asks this: is the Holy Grail worthy of any more reverence or veneration than the average chalice used at Mass, since they both hold the precious blood of our Lord?
I think the answer would be yes. They both have enormous dignity because they hold the blood of our Lord. But I would think that the Holy Grail would still be unique in two ways. First, it would be the grail that was the very first one to be used. And so that's going to make it special compared to other grails. And secondly, it was the one that Jesus held in his own hands. And that, I think, also would make it special. So not just because of it also would be, you know, very old and thus an antiquity and valuable for that reason. But in addition to all of that, I would say the fact that it's the first and that Jesus himself used it made it completely unique, and it would have special added reverence for that reason.
I just want to follow up on Kevin's question, because is there really such a thing as the Holy Grail? Is this like...
Well, there's going to be an upcoming episode of Mysterious World.
Oh, right? Come on, Jimmy. did people... I don't know. It doesn't play any part in early Christian history that we can see, right?
Right.
So it would have had to have disappeared and then...
Yeah, it's unclear. I mean, there are claimants. There are actually several claimants of this is the Holy Grail that are around in different parts of the world. But the authenticity of those is something that, you know, I haven't had personally the chance to investigate yet. Personally, I'm a little skeptical of that particular relic being preserved for all this time, because we don't have a what in archaeology is called a good provenance for it. We don't have records of it being used in the early centuries and being retained and people knowing where it was and things like that. There's a historical gap.
I got you. Yeah, right, fair enough. Okay. Well, it is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We got a lot more weirdness to go, so hang around. Before we go to the break, I would like to remind those of you who have an interest in possibly sailing with us down the Rhine next summer, June 9th through 19th, aboard a ship that will be entirely occupied by Catholic Answers folks and the crew of the ship, the Uniworld's River Empress. We're going to go through a whole bunch of towns, starting in Basel, Switzerland, and ending up in Amsterdam. We'll hit Aachen and Cologne and Trier, and we're going to kind of hit the heartland of medieval Christendom there. Chris Check will go. I'm going to get to go. Father Hugh Barber will be there. Our very special guest will be Archbishop Salvatore Corleone from San Francisco, and it's really going to be a wonderful little pilgrimage down the heart of medieval Christendom. CatholicAnswersCruise.com is the place to go if you'd like more information. CatholicAnswersCruise.com.
Hello, this is Archbishop Alexander Sample of the Archdiocese of Portland in Oregon. Keep that dial right here on Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back. Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Jimmy Akin, our guest, of course. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of the brand new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, which you can get in bulk, by the way, in much the way, same way we did with Trent Horn's book, Why We're Catholic. This is a book that is written to be persuasive and helpful to people at every level of their kind of introduction to and encounter with Christianity, and in this case, with the Bible in particular. And so you can head over to shop.catholic.com, maybe get yourself a set of 20. If you get in bulk, 20 or more, they're just $3 per copy, and you can share them with folks and bring them closer to the Bible and to the Catholic Church. Weird Questions means we got a lot of weird questions for Jimmy that came via the internet. Adam on Twitter, I do not know if we have had a question from Twitter before, but it's exciting to me to see it. Hypothetically, Adam says, if invented, would the church say that the use of a transporter or beaming up, as in beam me up, Scotty, would be the equivalent of suicide and or human cloning?
So it's going to depend on the way the transporter works. And there have been different accounts. We're talking about the Star Trek transporter.
Yeah.
There are other proposed methods of teleportation, some of which are destructive and some of which are not. So if it's not a destructive form of teleportation, it wouldn't involve either killing or cloning. But if it's a destructive form of teleportation, it would seem to involve both. On Star Trek, we've had different accounts that don't entirely jibe with each other about how the Star Trek transporters work.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, we have a bunch of instances where they'll talk about people being dematerialized and ripped apart atom by atom and having those atoms transmitted across space, or at least having the information transmitted across space and then reconstituted at some point. And if that's how it works, then the transporter kills you and makes a clone of you.
Yeah.
And what I like about this question is not just the does it kill you part, which has been discussed quite a bit, but not as many people have considered the other end of the process where you have this duplicate of you. Is that human cloning? And is it therefore immoral?
Oh.
And so not only would it seem, and I would say, yeah. Because not only is it immoral to kill a person, it's also immoral to clone a person. because we are bound by the system of human reproduction that God has, you know, built into our human nature, and we're not allowed to produce humans in other ways. So consequently, this would be producing a human in another way, would happen to be identical to someone else, which is also problematic. But you're coming up with a human not through marital lovemaking, and that's immoral. So, yeah, it would be. I would, though, say that this copy would have a human soul. God has apparently decided. I mean, we know it would have a soul because it would be alive.
Yeah.
If it didn't have a soul, it wouldn't be alive. And God has apparently made the determination that even if we come up with a human being through means he has not approved,
yeah,
like in vitro or adultery or rape or however you may be producing a human out of marital congress, that if we come up with the human body, he will endow it with the human soul.
Adam, great question.
I was going to say, though, there are other accounts on Star Trek that would cast some doubt on, is that really how the transporter works? There's an episode of Next Generation where Mr. Barclay, who's an engineer that they have in some episodes, played by a guy from the A-Team.
The guy from the A-Team, guy that played the kind of crazy
on his
guy.
Name. Yeah.
I don't remember.
Howling Mad Murdock?
That sounds right.
Yeah. I never watched that show. But
Jimmy.
He plays this somewhat neurotic engineer that they have, but who's really good at heart. And he develops what seems to be transporter psychosis, which is where the transport process destabilizes your brain. And they think that's what's happening to him. And in this episode, we actually get a first-person experience of what it's like to be transported from his perspective. And he's conscious throughout the process and is aware of what's happening throughout the process of being transported, including when he's dematerialized. And that would suggest that you're not actually killed. You're instead rearranged or reconditioned or reconfigured in such a way that you're not actually killed through the process,
mm-hmm.
In which case this would be non-destructive transportation and it would not be morally objectionable, at least on the grounds that I've seen.
Adam, thanks. Remember the time Commander Riker got transported and then there was two
of them,
Rikers?
Yeah. That would be another transporter cloning or twinning. Since we have clones in the real world, we call them twins.
Oh, yeah, right. Michael, here's a good weird question for us. Michael, via email, asks, is almond milk bad for the environment?
So I am not familiar with arguments. I may have heard it claimed that almond milk is bad for the environment, but I didn't.
Well, almonds are very water intensive.
Uh-huh.
You do have to. Almond trees require a lot of water.
Okay, fine. I would suppose that this is related. I mean, okay, so let's take the water thing. The thing about water is we have a hydrological cycle on Earth.
Oh, yeah,
so even if water goes into something, it's going to come back out again. And the amount of water in an actual almond is de minimis, and that gets ingested by, say, a human, and it's going to come out of the human too. So you're not diminishing the world supply of water permanently by growing almond trees. You may have local supply issues. Because like almond trees are native to Iran, and a lot of Iran doesn't, I don't know how much water they have there, but it may not be a lot.
Right.
So there could be local problems with that, but that's a local supply mechanics issue. It's not going to cause a global problem. In terms of what I initially thought this might be about, and I didn't have a chance to research it before the show because this question just came in today, but my first thought was that this is going to be another global warming thing. And because I could imagine someone saying, like they'll say, well, cows
are bad
for the environment because they're resource intensive and they emit flatulence, which contains
methane gases that's
going to harm the environment by promoting global warming. And I could imagine someone making a similar claim about almonds. However, I would find it a little strange because normally trees are proposed offsets
for
other things.
Yeah.
So you have these carbon offset tax credits in some countries if you plant enough trees. And so I think, well, why would almond trees be an exception? However that may be, you know, there are a lot of scientists who think that the world's getting warmer, and there are a lot of scientists who think humans are significantly responsible for that through the emission of greenhouse gases. Personally, I'm unconvinced of that. In fact, I'm a little bit skeptical of it because I've seen, as a student of the history of science, I've seen numerous examples where political fads and fashions run away and end up cooking the data. And this, because of the intense politicization of this issue, my spidey sense is going off. And there have even been instances where climate research scientists have been caught apparently cooking the data. There was that whole hide the decline scandal from a few years ago. But let's suppose that the world is warming and that humans are significantly responsible for it. What would that mean for almond milk? Well, I would have a couple of concerns about it. The first one is the amount of almond milk that the human race consumes is so small that it seems to me you would be better focusing your efforts on other larger issues than almond milk.
Like almond milk truck. Probably making
yeah, yeah. yeah. That you'd want to invest your efforts in combating greenhouse gases elsewhere rather than this.
Right.
Also, I've seen a lot of these fads happen where it's really, and I hate to psychologize these things because I don't like to psychologize other people's beliefs, but in this case, it's really hard to avoid noting that they're every year. There or more, there is some new, this is horrible for the environment, whether it's plastic straws or almond milk or cheeseburgers or whatever it is. Somebody somewhere, often some activist, will find a thing and mount a case that it's somehow bad for the environment. And people will run with this claim. Often there will be no research backing this up or really sloppy research. And the fact is that actually most studies, there's a bit of a crisis in science right now. Turns out most studies end up being wrong, the majority. And so I would be skeptical of the claim that almond milk contributes to global warming for that reason. There have not been huge major studies confirming this. This is would be highly speculative. And it's really driven by a process of anxiety and virtue signaling. We got to leap on this latest thing. It's bad for the environment. There are bigger fish to fry in the world than this. And we end up focusing on the wrong things if we worry about some of these trivial things, like, because the amount of almond milk people drink is small in the overall world economy, there are bigger issues that need to be dealt with, like, say, abortion.
Amen. Right. Michael, thanks so much. Appreciate that. It is a Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Jeff asks the following question. Jimmy, will we have couples with our resurrected bodies? From Genesis, it appears humans are built to be couples so we can see companionship throughout our existence. Now that doesn't mean all are like that. I'm not exactly sure what
I think he means. Not every person needs a companion in this life.
Oh, I got you.
Like hermits.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay, so do we have couples with our resurrected bodies?
Jesus makes it really clear that we're not going to be marrying or giving in marriage in the resurrection. And so we won't be having sex if we do have couples. Genesis does show us that, it doesn't say we're not going to have couples. And Genesis does show us that we're meant to be social creatures, and that there's nothing in divine revelation to contradict that for the future. The images we have of heaven in the afterlife depict choruses of people worshiping God and so forth. And so I think there's pretty good evidence we'll still have society, we'll still have social interactions. Whether we'll have a unique person that is our companion, that's a little bit harder because that sounds like marriage, and we know we're not going to have marriage. But it's not impossible, and I would assume people in the future will still, maybe based on what happened in this life, they'll still have special affection for certain people. They'll still have special friendships with other people. We do know they won't be sexual, but I don't see, I'd say it's kind of in the middle in terms of would there be companions. I don't see good evidence for it, but it's not impossible.
Jeff, thank you very, very much for that question. Hey, everybody's kind of talking, not everybody, but there's been talk going around about schism. The Pope mentioned it the other day. The word is sometimes pronounced schism. And then we
Such controversy over that.
Oh, such controversy over the pronunciation of that word. Also, you're seeing it a lot in the Catholic Twitterverse, which is also sometimes referred to as Catholic Hunger Games. There's, Jimmy was kind enough to sit down and we had a conversation, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes on schism. What is it? What does that mean in a technical sense? What does it mean? And then how does it happen? Because there have been schisms in the history of the church.
Yeah.
It's not like it's never
there are
happened.
Now.
Yeah, that's right, huh? Yeah. So if you have been attending to that and you'd like to hear a well-reasoned perspective on schism, what it is, what it means, and what the prospects for it are in the future, I'll just give you a small spoiler alert. Jimmy doesn't see...
I don't see the conditions being right yet.
Yeah. For
not
schism.
Presently.
Right.
But how would people hear this conversation if they were so inclined?
It is on Focus, our podcast. So you just go to CatholicAnswersFocus.com. You can listen to it right there, CatholicAnswersFocus.com. But you can also become a subscriber to Focus and get it every week. Just get it wherever you subscribe to your podcast, maybe at the iTunes Store or Google Play. It's there wherever you get your podcasts. CatholicAnswersFocus.com or just subscribe. We'll be back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our on-fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you subscribed to the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter? This is Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett, and I want to tell you about our new weekly newsletter full of behind-the-scenes information and facts you need to know about the show. It's easy to sign up. Just visit CatholicAnswersLive.com and look for the newsletter sign-up box on the front of the page. It's a great way to keep up to date with what's happening with the show and see what's coming in the days ahead, delivered weekly into your inbox. Sign up today for the Catholic Answers Radio Club newsletter and see what you've been missing. Go to CatholicAnswersLive.com.
Monday is the feast of St. Padre Pio.
Let's celebrate it on Monday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie at noon Eastern.
Now, let's get back to more of Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Jimmy's new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Jimmy, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. Been an apologist for...
26 years now.
Yeah. As long as I have been alive. I mean, I felt like I really came alive at 30.
Okay.
So I lost this person's name. I'll go. Oh. You know, I'm going to go back to that question because I accidentally just cut that off the document. But let's go to Elaine. Elaine's question is this, Jimmy. Could there possibly be a good God, and she has that in quotes, and a bad God, in quotes, equal in power, who each play a role in the Old Testament, New Testament, and even today? What a great question.
So this is a view that's sometimes called dualism. And there are other kinds of dualism, but this is applying dualism to the Godhead and saying, okay, there's these two gods, and one of them's good, one of them's bad, and they're otherwise equal. The answer to could there be two such gods? Not if you're talking about the kind of God that Christians worship. Now, if you're talking about the kind of God that Greeks, let's say, or Egyptians worshipped, where they're not really infinite beings, they're just more powerful than us.
They're like superheroes.
Yeah. Well, sure, there could be a superhero God and a supervillain God,
yeah,
to go with that analogy. But when you're talking about the kind of God that Christians worship, we worship an infinite absolute God that has and what that means is that God has all possible perfections, including moral perfection. He is all good. And therefore, any being that did not have perfect goodness, in other words, an evil being, could not be equal to the true God because he would be lacking the perfection of moral goodness. And that would have kind of cascading implications for his other attributes because it would end up reducing him to the status of a finite being. He wouldn't have this absolute all possible perfections, and that would end up reducing him to the status of a finite being and thus not a God in the sense of the God Christians worship.
I got two questions then. Can I do follow-ups?
Yeah.
Can I do weird question follow-ups? The first one is, wasn't there a kind of an early church heresy?
Mm-hmm.
I might be thinking of Marcion,
where
the Old Testament God was not the same as the New Testament God.
Marcion of Pontus, yeah. He wasn't the only one. Now, Marcion did think there were two gods. He thought the God of the Old Testament was a bad God and the God of the New Testament was a good God. And the problem with that, I was going to mention this, the problem with that is the New Testament affirms the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And as the word of God and of the true God, like in John's gospel, for example, Jesus says, you believe in God, believe also in me. So Jesus, and he's talking about the God they already worship as Jews.
Right.
So Jesus also quoted scripture. He quoted it as the word of God. And he regards himself as the son of the God of the Old Testament. So we have all this stuff affirming the unity of the identity of the God of the Old Testament with the God of the New Testament. It's just now we know more about him because we know he's a Trinity now. So the only way Marcion had to deal with that, or the way Marcion had to deal with that, is he cut all those passages out of the Bible. He produced a mutilated edition of the New Testament that was just an edited down version of the Gospel of Luke and an edited down version of Paul's epistles. He cut out everything he regarded as too Jewish. And the problem is that those weren't the scriptures that had been handed down from the apostles. That wasn't the faith that had been handed down from the apostles. So, yeah, there have been people in history like Marcion who proposed this. Also, many of the Gnostics proposed similar things. But it's not the faith that was handed down. This is not what the scriptures originally said. This was a mutilation of the scriptures.
All right, that'll do. Because let's go to Steve. Elaine, thank you for that question. Steve asks this. If we do evangelize species on other planets that are asexual, this is good. Could they become priests given that they would not strictly be male?
The answer to this is that the magisterium would have to make that determination. And actually, if you want more detail on this or theological implications about aliens, intelligent aliens, and what it would mean in terms of all the different sacraments, you want to check out episode 55 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, because we devote the entire episode to exploring those questions. What I say there is what I'd say here, which is the magisterium would have to determine it, but it is not clear that it would, it is not at all clear that they would be able to be ordained. And my assumption would be that just like in our species, the male gender is necessary in any other intelligent species. Even if they could be baptized, they would still probably need to have the male gender in order to be able to be ordained.
All right, Steve, thank you very, very much. We remain in space with Dan's question. Suppose we do have space colonies. We don't have to suppose that. There's already people in space. They're up there right now.
Not so much colonies.
Yeah,
though.
That's a good point.
It's a temporary research station.
Yeah. All right. Suppose we do have space colonies. If the second coming occurs then, will they continue? Is there a bishop and no cardinal out there who would pick the next pope? Oh, I get what's good. Okay, so if there is only one cardinal or bishop, does he get to be the pope automatically? So the idea then would be the second coming happens. This is the image I'm getting. You tell me if I'm reading this right. That means everybody that Earth is reunited with Christ, but apparently this person is thinking that in space, the second coming didn't happen, and so the church has to continue out there.
That seems to be the scenario he's envisioning, at least in the second part of the question.
Okay, so...
So... what we're talking about here is, you know how they have insurance policies for acts of God?
Yeah.
Like thunderstorms and stuff, which aren't properly speaking acts of God, but people call them that because they're not within human control.
Right.
So we're talking about a kind of act of God situation in a more literal sense in this case, where all of a sudden the earthly church isn't there anymore. So the pope vanishes, all the earthly bishops and cardinals vanish, and what happens in that case? But you have them left elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well, that's essentially the same scenario as suppose you have all the cardinals gathered in a conclave to elect a new pope.
Yeah.
And terrorists explode a nuke on the site. So suddenly the voting cardinals are all gone.
Yeah.
How is the church supposed to cope with that? I've actually thought about that for years, and so far as I know, there is not a provision in church law to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
But personally, I've wished they would craft one.
Yeah, because it actually doesn't seem completely out
not
of the
not these days. Yeah. And so I could imagine different scenarios, like you have a cardinal somewhere who's the designated survivor.
Yeah.
In such a situation, and he would then either become the pope or appoint the next pope. Just like we have designated survivors, there's whenever you have the president and the vice president and the cabinet together, like at the State of the Union, there's always one of them who's not there.
Right.
At an undisclosed location. I wish they'd do something similar for conclaves. Because these days with weapons of mass destruction, this is a real possibility.
Sure.
But they, thus far as I know, have not done that. It's certainly not in any public document. Having said that, if there were cardinals who are off the planet at the time the earthly church vanishes, then because Christ does not ask the impossible of the church, and he's indicated the church is to survive and is to have a successor of Peter. I would say exigent circumstances that have emerged would warrant the surviving cardinals to pick the pope. And if there's only one surviving cardinal, he could either assume the office himself or appoint someone else, not necessarily a cardinal, as pope. If there were no cardinals, it would fall to whatever surviving bishops there are. So that's what I would say would happen in those situations, because necessity, even though there's not a specific provision for this in the law, as we're envisioning it, necessity would require this action. And this is the most logical form of action. So it becomes a law in that it's would be passed by the highest legislators of the church at the time.
Yeah.
And it would be an ordinance of reason promulgated for the common good, and thus it would fit the definition of a law.
Yeah.
So they could go ahead and do that in that situation. But I don't think it's going to come to that, because when you – in this scenario
– Yes.
Because when you read about the second coming in Scripture, it seems like this is God's definitive wrapping up of the human race. all of the dead and all of the remaining living meet their ultimate fates. And so I would say if we have off-world colonies at the time of the Second Coming, they're going to be pulled into this too. And so I don't think there's going to be people left on Mars after the Second Coming. I think if there are people out in the heavens, they're going to be dealt with too.
Yeah, that's why I struggled with that, for because I guess that was even an assumption in my mind, and I didn't realize, it took me a minute to realize what Dan was asking. Dan, thank you for a great weird question. We'd love to give you the Catholic Answers Guide to Navigating the Bible. And I'm not just talking to Dan, I'm talking to anybody listening. The Catholic Answers Guide to Navigating the Bible, with contributions from Jimmy, who's here right now and has a brand new book called The Bible is a Catholic Book, Trent Horn, Carl Keating, and others. It's a treasure trove of information. Just visit shop.catholic.com and look for the free ebook banner, and you can have it for free, this brand new ebook from Catholic Answers, The Catholic Answers Guide to Navigating the Bible.
We'll be right back with more great answers from Jimmy today on Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
All people are called to communion with Christ in the church that he founded.
People really gravitate to David Anders and his concern for the callers.
Tom and I are both converts. We've walked that path, and we try to walk it with the listeners at whatever stage of the journey they're on.
It's EWTN's go-to source for non-Catholics, converts, and answer seekers.
Call to Communion TV with Dr. David Anders, Sunday afternoon, 4 Eastern, on EWTN Television.
Forgot it's Friday for a minute because Jimmy's here, and I thought I was going to get some groovy music, and but no, you did it. I'm not criticizing you, Nick. You did the groovy music this week, so
yeah, and on Thursday, which is the traditional day for it.
Yeah. I just got confused because Jimmy's here, and it's I just felt like it might
on
be
a Friday. Groovy music would just be an added bonus that for some reason Nick didn't want us to have.
No, that's and we're not criticizing you, Nick, for not
judgment.
Doing it.
No judgment.
No. If you don't want to play the groovy music.
You don't have to.
You're in charge of the music, Nick.
We should stop that because he'll stop playing it on Thursdays then.
Oh, yeah, really? Don't mess with Nick. He's going to hold that over our heads. Richard asks the following weird question. And the reason I say weird question, because it is a weird question, and this hour is Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Why is it specifically forbidden for Catholics to be Freemasons? I get that the religious indifferentism and the frivolous use of oaths are problematic, but it's odd that only one club is so explicitly banned. Is there something else?
So this is an interesting question because it has a couple of different dimensions that we need to untangle. Originally, in the 1917 Code of Canon Law, it did specifically mention the Freemasons and say you can't be a member of the Freemasons. It also, if I recall correctly, though, mentioned some other similar groups. That changed with the release of the 1983 Code of Canon Law. John Paul II made a decision to reframe the law so that it did not specifically name the Masons. And he was even queried about this, about, you sure you want to do this? And he said, yeah. What the law now says is that Catholics cannot be members of organizations that are attempting to subvert the church.
Okay.
So actually, church canon law does not say you can't be a member of the Masons. It says you can't be a member of an anti-Catholic subversive organization. However, this picture is complicated because the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith weighed in on the issue and said, for various reasons, including, you know, the indifferentism and stuff like that, you still can't be a Mason on doctrinal grounds, but not under that canon, because the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith is not the Pontifical Council for the Interpretation of Legislative Texts, and it can't issue an authentic interpretation of that canon. But John Paul II nevertheless approved the documents where the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith weighed in on this. And so
it's kind of a tricky situation involving both legal and theological elements. But the bottom line is, don't be a Mason. And it's not specific to them. There are other groups, too. Although the reason that Masons were named specifically historically, in addition to other groups like the Odd Fellows and people like that, the reason that they were, and the Orange Men and stuff, the reason that Masons were named specifically is Masons in several countries, not specifically the United States. In the United States, the Masons are often more just a men's club. They don't have specifically anti-Catholic designs. But in other countries, they have. In Europe and in Latin America, Masons have actively conspired against the church. And so that meant historically that the church produced and the popes produced a series of documents condemning the Masons. And so that's why historically they attracted more attention than other groups, because they were very active historically in a variety of countries trying to undermine the church.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard, for that question. You know, wait, listening to you answer that question, it makes me, I would rather live in a world with a lot of clubs. It doesn't seem like there's that many clubs anymore. Like there used to be a lot of, like even naming that, there's like the Odd Fellows. I don't think I even, but there used to be,
well,
it just seems like there was a lot more clubs.
I call
in the
regularly
days.
For five dance clubs.
Oh, yeah, so that's true. Yeah.
There are still clubs. Although there were these kind of fraternal clubs that were more popular.
Yeah, I want a club where I don't do anything. I guess that's what I'm saying.
Especially in the 19th century, dressing, having men's clubs where the men all get together away from the wife and kids and they dress up in outrageous uniforms and give themselves bizarre titles and do.
Like Grand Poobah.
Yeah, that's that. Those are all. That was the thing to do back in the 1800s. You know where Poobah comes from?
Mm-mm.
Grand Poobah, that's from the Flintstones,
yeah,
right? That's
right.
The Loyal Order of Water Buffaloes.
Yeah.
Poobah itself comes from a Gilbert and Sullivan opera. It comes from the Mikado. You have in the town of Titipu in Japan, you have Koko, the tailor who becomes the Lord High Executioner. And then you have Poobah, who is the Lord High everything else. He has all the other titles.
Margot asks this, Jimmy, regarding Our Lady of Fatima, why hasn't the church made her request, first Saturday devotion and daily rosary, mandatory and obligatory?
This would be a question that the popes would have to answer. However, I would note that the church doesn't consider private revelation to be binding on everybody. It's something that is offered as a suggestion to help people live in an authentically Catholic manner, in an authentically Christian manner, and to experience God's blessings. But it's not something that's mandatory and for people. And so consequently, that would, to my mind, create a challenge in mandating a practice recommended by a private revelation. I'd have to go back and review the documents, that are connected with Fatima, but I don't recall the Virgin Mary as being reported as saying, like, everyone must do this.
Yeah.
It was more of a, this is a good thing to do.
Yeah. Okay.
And so given that, and given the fact that private revelations are not considered binding on all the faithful, I would say would give the church reason not to mandate these things, although it obviously promoted them by allowing these documents, even in an age when canon law required much more serious approval of private revelations before their messages could be publicly discussed. It allowed them to be publicly discussed and promoted, and there have been societies founded that the church approves to promote the message of Fatima, and there have been popes themselves who have approved the message of Fatima and promoted it. And so I think it's when it comes to crossing the line into mandating something that the church would have more of an issue.
All right.
By the way, this October, so next month, two-part special on the third secret of Fatima, Mysterious World.
Very good. Okay, we're looking forward to that. Thank you, Margot, for the question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and here comes another one. Paul asks this. What's the church say about playing the lottery?
The church doesn't have any statement about the lottery specifically. Gambling is something that the church does not have a problem with, provided it's done in moderation. Because what you're doing when you're gambling, at least if you're doing it in a healthy way, what you're doing, and personally, I never gamble, so I don't have a dog in this race. Get it?
I bet that's true.
Yeah.
I was trying to come up with
there
something
you go.
That took
I
me
bet
forever.
That's true.
That was
that's
so
good.
Slow.
That's good. No, it was quick. You just could say it with more emphasis.
Okay, all right.
So I personally never gamble, but what someone is doing if they're gambling in a healthy, responsible way is they're paying money to be entertained. Well, that's like going to a movie or going out to a restaurant or buying a book or whatever you want. It's paying money to have fun. And there's nothing wrong as long as what you're doing is not intrinsically problematic, like buying porn or something, or buying, you know, drugs that are going to wreck your life. Then paying money to have fun is not a problem. And as long as you're not a gambling addict, and as long as you're not spending money on gambling that you should be using to, say, feed your children, you know, as long as you can afford it and it brings you pleasure and it's not an unreasonable portion of your income, it's fine. It's like any other spending money to have fun.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul, for that question. Peter asks this, Jimmy, related. Oh, if you have a 1 ounce. Oh, no. If you have an ounce of Lord's water in a 10 ounce bottle and add 9 ounces of tap water, then shake it up. Does the whole thing become Lord's water? Can this technique be used ad infinitum?
There is not a determination to this question, certainly on the doctrinal level, and I don't know any theologians who've dealt with it, and I don't think there's a theological consensus on this question. I would say, if I were to answer the question, I would say the answer is unknowable. That at this stage of doctrinal development, we haven't arrived at a way of determining the answer. What I would say is that God knows that if you're trying to extend Lord's water so you or someone else may have a blessing, let's say healing in connection with the Lord's water, I would say, and for people who may not be aware, Lourdes is a place in France where there is an apparition and there have been many miraculous healings connected with a spring there. So sometimes people will take water from that spring and you can, you know, get a bottle of it and give it to a sick person and so forth. I would say that if you're extending it to benefit a sick person, God knows that's your intention, and whether it's still in his mind, properly speaking, Lord's water, he knows what you're trying to do. He knows you're using it to ask for his healing in connection with this famous site of healings that he set up. And so I would say that that would give you hope for it providing some form of blessing, maybe not as great as pure Lord's water, but he knows what you're trying to do, and God loves you, and so forth. I would also say you don't want to be superstitious about this, because whether there's a healing or not, it's not the Lord's water that does it, it's God. This is using Lord's water as a way of asking God to do a healing. But in God's mind, is it still quote unquote Lord's water at that point? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. He might say, oh, well, if you take an ounce of Lord's water and you dilute it with 9 parts regular water, it's 1/10 Lord's water at that point.
Yeah, right.
God can do fractions.
Yeah, he can. I'm sure he can. Philip asks this, was Jesus really dead all day Holy Saturday and just waiting to come out on Sunday?
I would say yes, because even though you could imagine him reviving on Saturday and just waiting to come out, the picture we have presented to us in Scripture is of him, and this is, you know, in terms of his own words, he's going to be dead for 3 days and 3 nights. Now, that's hyperbole because it's not a full 72 hours. If you do the math, it's not a full 72 hours. So he's using a Hebrew approximative form of speech. One of the things you find when you study ancient metrology, or the study of measurements, is in the ancient world, people would frequently count parts for wholes. Mm-hmm. So if you have 13 months, they could say, oh, that's 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Jesus is not literally in the tomb by our hyper-precise reckoning
He's not literally in the tomb for three full days and three full nights, 72 hours. He's in the day for he's in the tomb for part of Friday, all of Saturday, and part of Sunday.
Right.
And it would seem to rub against Jesus's words, even acknowledging that they're somewhat figurative and that it's not full 72 hours. If you reduced it to he was just dead for Friday and part of Saturday.
Yeah.
And then he revived on Saturday and waited a bunch of hours. That would seem to reduce it to just 2 days. And in a way that's incompatible with Hebrew speech at the time. And so I would say that the implication based on Jesus's own statement is that even though it's not a full 72 hours, he was dead between Friday and sometime Sunday morning.
Thank you very much for that question, Philip. And thank you, Jimmy Akin.
My pleasure.
Another fine, weird questions with Jimmy Akin. We should do this again.
Let's do.
All right. If you got a weird question, send it to us. We got a million ways to get stuff to us. Tweet it, Facebook it, email it to Jimmy, email it to us here at the radio department. Jimmy's latest book is The Bible is a Catholic Book. It is out now. You can get it wherever you can get a Catholic book. And you can get it in bulk if you go to shop.catholic.com. Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. And we'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.